Hi, I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Jones, and this is the Secret Life of Neurohospitalists podcast. For today's episode, I'm talking with speech and language pathologist Maggie Grucci, who worked at Mission Hospital when I first started here in 2005. Since that time, so much has changed, including the fact that Maggie has pursued other adventures and no longer works with me. She now works as an outpatient provider at Care Partners. We took this opportunity to spend some time and reflect on the intersection of neurology and speech and language pathology. I'm hesitant to admit it, but I suspect that I'm guilty of not appreciating all the work that goes into the evaluations and assessments of a speech and language pathologist. As with other therapy modalities like PT and OT, I'm often looking for the bottom line, what the patient can and can't do. This is probably appropriate and no different than what we often do with consultants from any other specialty service. For example, if I consult renal for plasma exchange, I don't necessarily delve into the specifics of the exchange process, but just cut to the part that details the plan and duration. It's perfectly reasonable to trust that they've done their job appropriately and to cut to the chase. But I thought it would be nice to delve into some of the details of speech therapy and the lens through which they approach the neurology patient. How did you end up in speech and language pathology? Like, what was that path for you?
That started early on. I kind of knew that in high school. I knew I was applying to colleges that had the program. I was thinking nursing. My grandma was a nurse. And then one of the school advisors in the public library, anyway, she said, you need to go observe one of the speech therapists in the schools. And I did.
She had a good sense for your strengths and such.
Yeah.
And when you checked it out, did you love it right away?
Yeah.
It was like, what did you love about
it?
Can you remember?
Well, it was with the kids. It was in the elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just playing games and correcting speech sounds, delayed speech.
Right.
And felt so natural. But in grad school, I knew that I wanted to go into the medical component of it.
So there's kind of two arms, there's the educational and speech development
school
arm
tract, and then,
a medical more pathological.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so so you took that path, and then from a neuro perspective, because of course we rely on your input for, swallowing after a stroke and speech and everything. But then, you mentioned the other day even about working with ENT.
Yeah.
And who else, what other kind of specialist relies heavily on speech and language pathology as neuro does?
I hesitate to say heavily, but I know pulmonary and GI.
Like in pulmonary, is it with traits and such mostly?
Well, and even just the new kind of term we're using is air digestive disorders.
Okay, so, tell me about that.
Well, so breathing controls pretty much everything we do neck up, right? Speech, swallowing, voice, but a lot of pulmonary issues overlap with those. Because since COVID, a lot of this has really come to front, chronic cough. Okay.
Yeah.
So what is causing this chronic cough? It can be such a multi-layered diagnosis or really clinical picture to try to resolve.
It could be from reflux or lung inflammation or sinuses or...
Another ENT we were talking about chronic cough and treatments for it from his perspective. And he was talking about using nerve blocks because really if someone's been coughing and coughing, say they're coughing through COVID or they're coughing post-stroke because they have a paralyzed vocal cord, whatever, that nerve response gets hypersensitive.
Like it's a reflex.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Botoxing it or something.
Yeah. Or trying nortriptyline or...
And now, do you guys do Botox and such for spastic dysphonias and that?
Well, that would be, ENT would do that.
ENT would do that, yeah. Okay. In the hospital with neurology, we are primarily focusing on swallowing, but I think we probably underuse speech and language pathology for language.
Yeah, I mean, language is huge, and I think we always wanted to do more.
Well, and I think what do you know about the recovery? I guess that's the thing I think about too. Are we losing a valuable window of, not really getting in there and getting started on language recovery if we're missing these early days and sometimes weeks while a person waits for placement or whatever,
Kind of with swallowing, it's such a functional skill that it is always being addressed, Nursing's coming in, family's coming in. We're still trying to talk to that patient like they understand. I mean, there's a basic, right? Yes, no. What are they comprehending? And then we just kind of talk to them like they are understanding, unless it's something medical.
Right.
What's your pain? Did you already get your med? Those things you can't count on them. But it was fun to kind of focus on aphasia. I would go in and do an assessment and then come out and kind of geek out with him on the subset of aphasia. You know, like, I think it's transcortical motor. I think you're right. You know,
and
those were some really fun, great teachable moment days. But no, I think it's just a matter of time. But I think if we can talk to the patient as much as possible.
I remember when I first came here and I finished my board. So all the nuance about aphasia types was fresh in my head and mm-hmm. I could readily apply it. Unlike now, I mean, I can do sort of Broca's and Wernicke's and it's like, oh, the rest is a little
That's
bit
where
like,
I stop.
You know, mm-hmm. But then, and I wrote something like it's a, you know, transcortical sensory or whatever, aphasia. And I think it was you or maybe it was Ann Lee or somebody uh-huh. who said something like, well, I'll be the judge of that. Like, you know, we'll see.
I don't think it was me. I remember that though. She knows our language.
Now I'm like, yeah, they can repeat.
Yeah.
That's all I know. Is there any tool that is specific that other than like you're saying, like talking to people mm-hmm. and getting, I do think it's so interesting too, like about language, like how they will just, you know, not be able to answer a yes, no question, maybe like mm-hmm. a Wernicke's or something. They can't repeat, but they are definitely comprehending all kinds of extraneous information. Like they get the prosody and the tone and the setting. Like they're picking up so much other mm-hmm. information mm-hmm. about what's going on. They know they've been asked a question and they're responding with the appropriate, you know, again, you know, inflection
yes.
and everything. But it's just like the words are meaningless and it must be very strange to be in that experience.
For the patient?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, is there anything that is specific to getting them back to that comprehension, like a tool or anything?
Every day we would reassess.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing about inpatient. You know, I remember when I was there and I'm like, why are we not diagnosing their speech and language? We're not writing in the chart, you know, expressive aphasia or whatever. And I remember my colleagues were like, well, because every day they're different.
Well, that is true.
Every day we're reevaluating. And I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it does recover.
Because there's so much spontaneous recovery mm-hmm. in those early days too.
Yeah.
Which we love.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Even if like a person in training goes in,
yeah,
and they come out, they're like, oh, they can't repeat or whatever. And you go in an hour later, you know, it might wax and wane throughout the day or whatever.
Yeah. But I think it's hard to keep it objective. That I would notice is oftentimes nurses or families would come out and say, he says he's answering all the questions correctly. And then if I would go in with my really objective mm-hmm. assessment, and also I was watching, you know, these are the things we learn in school, right? You watch your body language, you watch your prosody, you watch your nonverbal cueing, and then you can get a clearer assessment on what they're really understanding or not. Because everybody wants to get the response. You know, if you answer yes to people's questions, you get a much more positive reaction.
And so, don't you think that families like are people who are not trained in like how to ask both a yes and a no question
absolutely.
would generally ask, am I your daughter? They ask natural yes questions.
Well, and even with your inflection with those examples.
You're right.
It was obvious.
That is a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, and that was something that I felt was a challenge, was kind of pointing out maybe where the patient wasn't really comprehending. You know, I always felt kind of like the bad guy coming in and being like, my assessment doesn't show that they're understanding, but it can be different tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think the daily, you know, assuming that it's a dynamic recovery and that every day you're going to go in and see something different. Really.
Now, okay. So talk to me some about what you're doing right now. You're not doing that type of stuff.
I'm an outpatient.
Right.
So we do have, we definitely see neuro patients. The bulk right now is voice.
Oh, okay.
And probably Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah,
like
a lot of Parkinson's,
so
neuro
and stuff.
Yeah. Neuro voice that way.
Yeah. Well, and so there's some good stuff for that, right? There's some real effective techniques.
You know, there's LSVT Loud, which is kind of the old school, original, gold standard. And then there's some other programs that are very similar to that.
What is that? I don't know, being inpatient, I don't know much about what that involves. What does that involve?
Well, the funny thing about it is that it's really just based on repetitive amplitude building, repetitious exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It's just repeating the target function. Good loud voice, over and over and over.
And it does help.
It does with Parkinson's and some other, you know, along the line of mm-hmm. Parkinsonisms and more neuro-based. And it can be tedious, but usually you can see results and have improvement within 20 minutes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And lasting improvement? Or do they have to do this throughout the day intermittently?
The exercises produce dopamine.
Right.
Right. Oh. So
that's interesting. So that's just sort of for you, it's a little tedious, like it's sort of like teaching kindergarten or something.
Well, and convincing the patient that that's all it is. You know, they come in wanting my magic wand, which I've still not found, right? Yeah. So it's a lot of showing them and having them do it to really buy into it.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of work.
They just like any exercise, right? You just got to commit.
Really? This is it?
Okay, so with Parkinson's, what I recall, again, it's not really something I do much in the inpatient except for just make recommendations for med adjustments or whatnot, but not really managing all the features. I can think a lot of how there can be a dynamic in couples where the person with the disease frustrates the non-Parkinson's spouse who's like, you're not trying, you're not doing enough. You know, you need to do your exercises, you need to do this. And then, of course, recognizing that the bradykinesia and stuff is a part of it can be a challenge.
Absolutely.
Do you see that dynamic
Absolutely.
A lot?
Yeah. First day one. And I always have the spouse or the partner or the caregiver, whoever their support person is. I've just tried to start using who's your support person. And I encourage both patient and support person to get their hearing checked. Number one. And that first visit, I talk a lot about those dynamics.
Do you?
From the get-go.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable.
To have them have their reasonable expectations.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And just to put it out on the table.
Yeah.
And that seems to kind of put everybody, you know, usually oftentimes a wife look at me and roll her eyes and kind of be like, thank you. I got you.
Yeah.
Like, I've been doing this a while.
Yeah.
And this is real stuff.
Right.
Yeah, this is legitimate. But also part of with Parkinson's is that patient has lost some of their ability to monitor their volume or their gait's, you know, length. And they might be trying, but they still don't have that connection.
Well, and it's like, that is so interesting, right? Like it might be a bit like receptive aphasia and you're speaking and you think that you're speaking correctly. And, you know, because when people have had, for example, thrombectomy, then you ask them what happened. They'll say, well, and they told me I wasn't making sense. Like a lot of times they don't necessarily know that the words that were coming out were just, you know, word salad and whatnot. And I wonder if it's like that, like they just think their volume is normal.
Yeah.
I guess that's a type of apraxia or anosognosia or something, you know, I don't know.
We have a patient right now who had a stroke and she had a big stroke. And I don't remember where actually, but the first time she came in, she was very nervous and overwhelmed with the change from leaving inpatient to outpatient. And we, as a team, couldn't get a finger on, is this anxiety? Is this now a personality, behavioral component here? Or is this truly language? Like she is not comprehending anything.
And she's just going where she's told to go.
And she
or whatever,
was
go.
Very, and I'm still working with her now and she's a totally different person.
So she's recovered a lot of language?
Yeah, she has apraxia and, you know, that's just hard. But I'm kind of curious to see if there will be a day when I can ask her if she remembers, first day or two in the clinic and how she felt and honestly how she was acting.
Because that would be interesting.
Yeah.
And you think you'll be able to have that conversation?
I don't know. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
And she's working on it.
So you see real progress. I guess that's another nice thing to hear, you know, again, with the inpatient, of course, in the outpatient, I know that language in particular can take a long time, and even years.
Yes.
You know, and I tell patients that they, our families, that recovery can be quite protracted with language, you know, and even, so it's nice to hear about people making real progress, you know, even in the short term.
I think what I've seen is once people get back into their home environment, things really take off one way or the other. It becomes very clear once they're back home, are they able to manage their medications? You know, are they remembering to close the door and turn the light off or manage the pet or, you know, ambulate safely and prepare a microwave dinner. Like that's when the language.
Right. Becomes very pertinent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And either they're going to feel a lot more motivated, especially if they're a young stroke survivor, you know, they've got kids or multiple family members at home, or they're trying to get back to work. Those motivating factors really, I think, are going to make it clear.
Yeah.
Fast.
So you see a real motivational shift once they get back into their environment.
Or not.
Yeah. One way or another. Mm-hmm. What do you think about when they are seemingly disengaging or sort of losing their motivation? Is that something you got any intervention for?
Oh, I wish I had a quick answer on that one. Mm-hmm. No. Depends. I mean, it really depends, again, on their support system. And a lot of how they were pre-morbid. You know, what were their stressors?
Yeah.
Where were they at before this?
That's right, because it doesn't just happen out of the blue in a, you know, perfectly primed, you know, person who's got all the benefits for a good, fast recovery.
Yeah. And what does their insurance even cover? Yeah. So the access issues are often, can they get transportation to get to therapy, rehab.
Yeah. Tell me about this relationship with neurology and speech and language.
I love neurology.
Like, I feel...
I've been waiting to say that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk some, because I probably do not attend adequately. Sometimes I get a lot of information, you know, it's so busy.
Yeah.
And I often will just kind of defer and not really lean in. Like if somebody's saying, I want to do another SPEES or swallow study, you know, a day from now or something. Yeah. I'm just like, okay, fine. Right. That's what you think. That's fine.
Neurology to me is the discipline, the specialty that understands speech the most. I mean, those were my favorite classes in grad school. Those were the classes I wanted to keep taking over and over and over. There's no language without the brain. I mean, hello. I mean, we could say the same thing about the voice and lungs, but we're talking about neurology. And so, you know, those early days, we were really working on those protocols that allowed you all to trust us to make, you know, we got those order sets that were like, okay.
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't without work and discussion and finding common language, which is, you know, so beneficial. You know, it was work to get there, but I think we always are feeling that we could do more and we'd like to be seeing more patients. And I think that neurology brings us in and allows us that space.
And do you get pushback from other docs sometimes, and why? I guess I sometimes think, like, why would you object to?
I know.
I mean, unless you're just some sort of purist thinking, well, that's going to cost the patient money, but I don't know how much anybody's looking at things that way.
I don't know. And I used to think it was maybe me and my personality that I didn't want to really push myself in there and come across as like kind of egocentric, like, well, we should be seeing all the patients, you know, we're as important as anybody else. There is a little speech versus physical therapy. I think physical therapists were always got the consults and speech was like, but are they talking? Are they, do they know where they're walking? Like, okay, we can help with that too. Why are we so uncomfortable advocating for our services? And I think, you know, over 20 years, it's gotten better.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I think it's the subsystems within our healthcare system.
And like the institutional support for it. Because like even what I'm seeing with all therapy modalities is just inadequate staffing, right? There's just not enough. I feel like that desire to have expanding your services, I wonder if anybody's got that perspective right now in the hospital, given that it's like, it seems to me that everybody's struggling just to keep up.
Yes.
Like the thought of forward thinking as to where can we extend would just be like a thing of the past.
Right. Right. Well, and I think that's why even in the inpatient, even the focus for speech and neuro is still swallowing.
I mean, every now and then I'll remember to order like a cognitive eval, you know, that
but
we
they don't
get.
Have that. I don't even think the speech team has enough time. We want to do it, but it's just not.
And that's the super fun stuff, right?
I think
I love
so.
That. I know. And I wish I could.
Time
have
of
time
the day, right? I remember Dr. Taylor. Well, back then we were calling them conversion, but now we know they're functional neurological.
Right.
And there was a patient, and he said, "Go in and do your best evaluation and then come out and let's talk." And so I was like, okay. Yeah. And he came out, or I came out, and we talked about it. He was waiting. He didn't say anything else. And then I said, I don't think that's a legit aphasia. And he said, we need to start a study. We need to start videoing these patients.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, And then I remember going, but when?
And like, how? Yeah.
I don't have the time to figure that one out right
getting
now.
Permission for a video.
We were like in a research institution, maybe.
When we used to have that bandwidth.
Time.
I mean, I guess we have to just make it.
Yeah. And even, you know, with patients, we have to do real-time documentation. You know, we're typing, you know, my doctors do it to me. They're typing while I'm, yes, you know, and they're yes. looking back and forth. And so I really try to at least, and this is, it just sounds so crazy when you say it out loud, I try to give them like 5 minutes.
I mean, right?
When I'm not typing or gathering handouts because I don't have enough time. And so I'm going to put it in written yeah. form so they can take it home and probably leave it on their kitchen table.
Right. Right.
And maybe read it when they're better able to receive it.
And that's just everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Right. That's just the model that we're predicated on.
And I think too, that people remember if you can give them 3 to 5 minutes of undivided attention.
It's an important thing. It's a good thing to be reminded of.
Absolutely.
What would be the thing you'd change? Maybe it'd be that, just like take the pressure off, have more people around so we could actually spend the time. But what from a speech and language pathology perspective could be different or better from what you're remembering about the inpatient world?
Back to the communication part of it, like we had rounds, and I think they've evolved a lot, you know, that multidisciplinary.
Yeah.
We just always are craving more team communication.
Yeah.
Because that's how we learn. You know, that's why I think neurology is as a specialty is such an advocate for speech, right? Because yeah. you understand more what we do.
Right.
And that in itself is going to, you know, just carry over into better referrals, more appropriate referrals, more
specific
inter-team.
Yeah. Well, and the other planning. Thing is like things change and without some some sort of formalized exchange, you know, I can learn about some new device or something from a patient's family who's researched it online. And it's sort of like, how do you keep up? You know, like everybody right. needs this common communication about what's new and what is new, anything, what's changed like most dramatically for you over the years of doing it. I mean, obviously your role has changed some, but has mm-hmm. there been any real shift in the like sort of perspective that you've recognized?
Well, I think like you said, when patients and family members come in with all this research mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh,
and they're like, they expect you to know it.
Yeah. All
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
Definitely a reliance on technology for sure.
Yeah. And okay. I'll be right back.
Yeah. I think a lot of the speech generating apps are super helpful, but they just change and update and, you know, patients' phones maybe aren't as up to date in software. And so a lot of that is a shift and something that in my younger days, I probably would have been a lot better at.
Has there been what about the newer generation versus, you know, the yeah. people that you came up with, mm-hmm. differences that you can detect in their approach or?
Yeah.
Tell me about
it. Yeah, I think that the differences a lot are on standardizing assessments and treatment, more assessments, I would say, and just protocols for care. I see this a lot more in inpatient and I see it indirectly, right, as yeah. an outsider. Yeah. But I still do swallow studies. So we share that same, you know, we do the same form and,
right.
and our goal is to standardize it. So it carries from inpatient to outpatient. And that is in theory, fantastic. But I think that where I didn't have that level of protocol, especially with swallow studies, I just think there needs to be room for clinical judgment.
Right, because otherwise it's just going to be AI, right? I mean, is
yes,
this a thing that's
exactly.
eventually just going to be AI? Probably not. Like there might be some role for, I mean, any of it, neurology, anything can, you know, there's going to be some algorithmic approach. It could be applied to some percentage of it. But then there's, like you're saying,
yes.
the clinical judgment aspect that
yes.
requires.
You know, there has to be room for adaptation and welcoming in new assessments and changing the way you think. But colleagues that are around my age and experience level, we always say, but the form and function is still the same. The structures are still the same. We're still looking
right.
at the same function. It doesn't change.
Yeah, nothing's changed much
yeah.
from that. Yeah,
I mean, we
yeah.
might look at functional swallowing disorders differently, right? They're
right.
passing their tests, but there's still symptomology and those are real symptoms. I like that there's a common language. I like that there's that move to standardize for sure. And I think it helps with interprofessional communication as well
for
when
sure.
you're passing off.
Yeah.
But I think we need to be comfortable with defending our adaptation of a protocol to meet the needs of the patients. But I think that things aren't fundamentally changing. We're just getting more comfortable accepting, I think, the unknowns and the need for collaboration, and that we have to be more focused on symptom management and just getting the patient to feel better.
Yeah.
For all the ways that a stroke can knock out our processes like vision or balance, movement, locomotion, speech is the most frustrating for caregivers, doctors, and of course, for the patient. What struck me in the conversation with Maggie is how much attention a good speech and language pathologist gives to each of the elements of communication: speaking, reading, writing, comprehending, chewing, swallowing. There are so many details to attend to in these acts that are core to our human existence and that we can easily take for granted until they're dysfunctional. Thanks again to Maggie for her time and thoughtful insights with this conversation. That's all for today. We'll be back with a special episode next month and with readers' comments. And don't forget to like, rate, and share this podcast. If you have questions or comments, please email us at secretlifeneuro@gmail.com.